Welcome to the debate. Imagine a world where the only way to measure a government's success is by taking its pulse.
Literally taking its pulse.
Literally. Not by looking at GDP or, you know, tracking stock market indices, but by physically measuring whether the biological and social capacity for life is expanding or contracting.
Right.
If you're listening to this and wondering how on earth a biological concept applies to, say, your city council or global trade agreements, well, that is exactly the frontier we are exploring today. We're looking at a paradigm shift where we stop treating society like a machine that needs to be driven and start treating it like a living organism that needs to heal.
And the stakes of that shift are monumental. I mean, because if society is sick, and I think most people looking around at our institutions today would agree that it is, the central political question of our time is how we treat that illness.
Exactly.
Do we heal it through systemic redesign from the ground up? Or does an entrenched disease require a forceful, aggressive intervention from the top down?
And that exact dilemma is the focus of a really remarkable white paper by Dr. Bechara Sali, published in May 2026. It's titled From the Biology of Love to Life Coherent Governance. It is an incredibly ambitious text.
Mm-hmm. Ambitious is a good word for it.
Right? Dr. Sali proposes integrating four distinct intellectual frameworks. So we have Humberto Maturana's biological theories of autopoiesis, Johann Galtung's concepts of structural violence, John McMurtry's life value criterion, and Eleanor Ostrom's work on commons governance. The goal is to weave these into a single, cohesive framework for what he calls life-coherent governance.
Yeah, and the core tension we are unpacking today emerges directly from that synthesis. The paper essentially asks, can political governance truly be modeled on biological self-organization and a non-forcing biology of love?
Right.
Or does translating the way cells and organisms coexist into a political architecture fundamentally fail to account for the mechanisms actually required to dismantle entrenched institutional capture?
Well, I'll be arguing that grounding politics in objective biological realities isn't just a nice metaphor. It provides a necessary, scientifically grounded blueprint. It offers an empirical way to replace our currently pathological systems with life-enabling civil commons.
And I'll be arguing that while this text offers one of the most profound diagnostic tools I've ever read, equating a biological mechanism with political governance is a massive category error. Ultimately, relying on a non-forcing framework leaves us fundamentally toothless against the very systemic capture the paper so perfectly describes.
So, let's lay out the groundwork. When I look at the ethical political arc detailed in this white paper, I see a necessary revolution in how we evaluate our institutions. The text argues that we currently live under money sequencing.
Let's define that for a second.
Sure. Money sequencing is a paradigm where price, profit, and growth are the primary organizing logics of society. Under the system, an institution, say a massive healthcare conglomerate or a fossil fuel company, survives financially only by disabling biological, social, or ecological viability.
Right. It extracts more than it regenerates.
Exactly. And the paper beautifully reorients this by demanding a shift to life value. In this framework, the only objective way to evaluate an institution is whether it enables or disables the coherent ranges of thought, felt, being, and action for living beings.
Which is a brilliant metric. I mean, it really is. But the implementation is where I start to see the cracks. I want to acknowledge the sheer brilliance of combining Galtung's violence triangle with McMurtry's life value compass.
It's a powerful combination.
It is. For those unfamiliar, Galtung showed us that violence isn't just direct physical injury. It is structural, meaning the harm is built silently into our social arrangements, and it is cultural, meaning the media narratives and economic dogmas that legitimize that structural harm. Pairing that diagnostic grammar with a life value metric is a masterstroke. However, my deep contention lies with how the text expects us to solve this. It leans on Eleanor Ostrom's non-forcing governance and the concept of wu-wei, which the paper defines as acting without violating the autonomy of living systems.
Well, because the moment you violate that autonomy, you recreate the very domination you are trying to escape.
But you cannot cure an entrenched money sequencing pathology without some form of top-down commands or forcing. We are talking about institutions that survive specifically by predating on life means. We're talking about global financial architectures and captured administrative states.
I hear that, but
the text's own section on institutional capture describes mechanisms of friction and domination that this so-called biology of love simply cannot accommodate. By insisting on a non-forcing methodology, the solution becomes fundamentally incompatible with its own diagnosis.
Wait, let me stop you there. When you hear biology of love, I think the immediate reaction is to assume we are talking about running a government on sentimentality or good vibes.
Yeah, a bit, yeah.
But to truly unpack this, we need to look at the biological bedrock the paper establishes, which is Humberta Maturana's concept of autopoiesis. Let's break that jargon down. Auto means self, poiesis means creation.
Mm-hmm.
Autopoiesis is the process by which a living system, like a cell, continuously produces and maintains itself. Think of it like a self-sustaining city where every output perfectly becomes an input for something else. Right, it's a closed, self-referential loop of maintenance.
Exactly. And the text is very careful to explain that these living systems are autonomous. A living system does not receive instructions from the outside like a machine. If you type code into a computer, the computer obeys. If you try to force a living system, it changes according to its own internal structure in reaction to that environment.
Structural coupling.
Yes, structural coupling. The organism and the environment interact, constantly triggering changes in one another. This is why the paper insists that living systems cannot be commanded from the outside without causing distortion or harm. True healing doesn't force the body into a state of health.
Okay, but if you get a cut, the bandage doesn't do the healing. The body heals itself. The bandage just creates the systemic conditions, you know, keeping bacteria out, keeping moisture in, so the body's autopoietic nature can do the work. Life-coherent governance is the political equivalent of that bandage.
I come at it from a different way. I understand the elegance of the metaphor. But equating a cell's structural coupling to a citizen's relationship with a global economic state is a profound category error.
How so?
Well, the biological principles of autopoiesis apply to cellular networks interacting with natural environments. But a political economy is not a natural environment. It has intent. The white paper itself points out this danger in its section on technology and artificial intelligence.
Right, the AI section.
Yes. It notes that modern technological systems actively manipulate, de-skill, and intensify surveillance. These are algorithms expressly designed for behavioral modification.
Which the paper explicitly flags as a pathology.
Yes, but look at the reality of how these algorithms function. How exactly does an autonomous citizen biologically couple with a black box algorithm designed by a monopoly to extract their attention for profit? You cannot structurally couple with a system that is fundamentally designed to negate your autonomy. The biological metaphor breaks down because the environment we are interacting with has asymmetric predatory agency. In nature, the weather doesn't plot to addict the cell. In our economy, the platforms absolutely plot to addict the citizen.
I see why you think that, but let me give you a different perspective. The technology example actually proves the power of the framework rather than dismantling it. The paper states that these extractive technologies are, quote, political niches that shape future life capacity.
Exactly. They shape it negatively.
Right, but the framework isn't suggesting that we sit back and peacefully couple with an extractive AI. It is demanding that we evaluate the AI using the life value criterion. We must ask, does this system enable or disable human domains of action?
Okay.
By identifying the AI as a mechanism of money sequence capture, the framework gives us the objective grounds to say, this technology violates the conditions for coexistence. The biology of love isn't about accepting exploitation. In Maturana's terms, love is simply the domain where the other arises as a legitimate other in coexistence.
Right.
So if an AI platform treats you as a data point to be mined rather than a legitimate other, it is biologically anti-life. It narrows our domains of action, and therefore it must be structurally removed to allow true self-organization to occur.
But removing it requires confronting the cultural apparatus that protects it, which brings me right back to Galton's triangle.
Okay, let's talk about Galton.
The paper leans heavily on Galton's concept of cultural violence. This is the symbolic layer, the ideologies, the media narratives, the economic dogmas. Let's make this concrete. Think about the economic narrative that a certain baseline percentage of unemployment is necessary to discipline labor and control inflation.
The Phillips curve logic, right?
Exactly. That is cultural violence legitimizing structural violence. If a society is thoroughly culturally captured by that idea, presenting them with an objective life value dashboard isn't going to wake them up.
Why not?
Because their perception of what constitutes reality is already altered. They don't see the engineered poverty as violence. They see it as the natural, unavoidable order of the economy. You can show them all the biological metrics in the world, but if their cognitive framework is captured, they will reject the diagnosis entirely.
That's an interesting point, though I would frame it differently. That is a very real obstacle, but this is precisely why the synthesis with John McMurtry's work is so critical to the paper. The text doesn't just offer a dashboard of abstract metrics, it positions the civil commons as the actual physical social metabolism of a life-coherent society.
Define the civil commons for the listener, because it's more than just a public park.
Right. The civil commons refers to tangible, universal infrastructures. We're talking clean water systems, food security, universal primary care, ecological protection. Physical life necessities have a way of cutting straight through cultural narratives.
Mm-hmm.
You might be able to culturally justify why a factory needs to be profitable, but you cannot culturally justify away a polluted watershed when your child's biological reality requires clean water to survive.
That's fair.
The framework argues that human rights only become real when they are backed by the civil commons. By focusing on these universal life necessities, things every single human being across every culture biologically requires to live, the framework bypasses the cultural relativism that traps so many political theories. It establishes a life ground duty that is empirically verifiable. If the water is toxic, life capacity is disabled. End of story.
Yes, the biological necessity of clean water is undeniable. But who controls the water? And how do you take it back when it's been privatized?
Well, that's where Ostrom comes in.
Right. This is where we have to look at the actual mechanism of change proposed in the text, which relies on Eleanor Ostrom's work. The paper champions Ostrom's findings that governance isn't a strict binary between heavy-handed state command and absolute market privatization.
Exactly.
It suggests that communities can self-organize durable commons institutions through wu-wei or non-forcing governance.
Exactly. I mean, Ostrom won a Nobel Prize for proving that when rules are locally meaningful, collectively revisable, and nested across different scales, what she called polycentric governance, communities can manage shared resources without requiring a centralized coercive state to force compliance from above. It's governance that supports self-organization with accountability to life value.
I'm sorry, but I just don't buy that. Let me tell you why. Let me walk you through a scenario to explain why I find that insufficient for the scale of our current crisis.
Okay, let's hear it.
The white paper explicitly features a section called Limits and Safeguards. In that section, Dr. Saley notes that power must be named and that institutional capture often benefits identifiable actors and corporations. So, let's say a global conglomerate is extracting millions of gallons from a local aquifer to sell back to the public in plastic bottles.
A common scenario, sadly.
Very common. They are legally and structurally mandated by their shareholders to subordinate life value to money value. How exactly does a local community use non-forcing coordination to stop them?
Whoa.
Trying to regulate a global monopoly with local wu-wei restraint is like trying to stop a freight train by politely asking the tracks to reorganize themselves. The scale of the inertia is completely mismatched. The very diagnosis of institutional pathology provided in the text necessitates a coercive mechanism to unseat those entrenched powers.
I'm not convinced by that line of reasoning because I think you're misunderstanding how Ostrom's polycentric governance actually functions in practice, and you're equating non-forcing with passivity.
Am I?
Yes. The text anticipates this exact critique. It explicitly defines non-forcing action as including restraint as well as action. It specifically lists interventions like stopping extraction and removing coercive conditions.
But how does a community stop extraction without forcing the extractor?
by utilizing the overlapping layers of polycentric governance to create friction that makes the extraction non-viable. It's not just one local council asking politely.
Okay.
It is the municipal utility cutting off secondary infrastructure access. It is the regional water board leveraging a distinct set of bylaws to revoke a specific use permit. It is the local workforce refusing to provide the labor to operate the plant based on community sanctions. These are graduated sanctions.
Mm-hmm. When a medical professional removes a tapeworm from a patient, they are not forcing the patient's body. They are removing a coercive condition so the body's natural autopoiosis can resume.
In the political realm, utilizing overlapping legal and social sanctions to strip a corporation of its ability to exploit a watershed is not forcing the community. It is removing a structural violence that was previously imposed upon them. We systematically dismantle the mechanisms of domination so that democratic participation can organically flourish.
That's a compelling argument, but have you considered the inherent paradox in that framing? You are calling it removing a parasite, which sounds very clinical and metabolic. But to the parasite, it is lethal force.
Well, sure.
Stopping extraction inherently means taking away resources, property, or legal rights from the entities currently holding them. You cannot revoke a multinational corporation's extraction rights without applying massive top-down state friction. The legal system has to enforce that permit revocation. The police power of the state ultimately backs it up.
But
the framework claims it wants to avoid domination, but dismantling structural violence inherently requires dominating the dominators. By wrapping this necessary political confrontation in the biological language of non-forcing coordination, the framework obscures the very real political friction required to achieve its own goals.
I don't think it obscures it. I think it recontextualizes it.
It treats the removal of entrenched power as a simple act of ecological restraint. Historically, removing structural violence requires immense organized coercion against those who currently benefit from the status quo.
But if we accept your premise that we must dominate the dominators, we remain permanently trapped in the very cycle of violence Galtung describes. We end up reproducing the exact pathology of external control we are trying to cure.
How so?
The white paper defines this political pathology as civilizational drift. The recurrent conservation of institutions and habits that reproduce life disablement. If we use the tools of money sequencing, coercion, fear, and top-down domination to overthrow money sequencing, we just conserve a new form of structural violence.
So we are just trapped?
No, that's the brilliance of integrating Ostrom as the third way. We shift the metabolism of society so that extractive behaviors simply lose their viability over time. Think about how a healthy immune system naturally sidelines a pathogen without destroying the host.
Right. It changes the chemical environment. It marks the pathogen so that it can no longer successfully couple with the host cells. Through polycentric governance, we change the legal, social, and economic environment. We make the cost of extraction so high, structurally and culturally, that the money-sequenced institution can no longer survive without adapting to life value. We don't have to launch a centralized war against the conglomerates. We simply coordinate the civil commons to cut off its access to our life means.
The immune system analogy is fascinating, but we have to remember that immune systems are incredibly violent at the cellular level. Well, violence is a strong word for cells.
It's true, though. Macrophages hunt, they engulf, and they destroy foreign bodies with enzymes. It is a microscopic war zone. My concern is that by relying on Ostrom's localized commons governance, the framework vastly underestimates the adaptive resilience of money-sequenced institutions.
Eleanor Ostrom herself admitted that her principles of commons governance do not always scale perfectly to global, transnational issues like climate change or globalized finance.
Which is precisely why the paper synthesizes her work with McMurtry's global life value criterion. It scales the ethic, even if the governance remains polycentric.
But ethics don't enforce themselves. The paper's Life Coherent Governance Dashboard is genuinely a masterpiece of evaluation. Asking whether an institution expands life capacity or conserves itself by disabling life is exactly the right question we should be asking. I'm glad we agree on that.
We do. But when that dashboard indicates that a global financial institution is systematically disabling life across three continents to conserve its profit margins, local self-organization and Wu Wei restraint are insufficient mechanisms for intervention.
So you think it lacks teeth?
Yes. The diagnostic power of this text is unparalleled. It gives us the exact vocabulary we need to articulate why our current systems feel so destructive. But the prescriptive mechanisms, the actual toolkit for treating a society in the late stages of this disease, lack the necessary teeth to survive the reality of the political arena.
I think this is where we have to zoom out and look at the whole picture the white paper provides. For decades, we have lacked a comprehensive, objective blueprint for society that isn't just, you know, another ideological ism.
Right.
By synthesizing Maturana, Galting, McMurtry, and Ostrom, Dr. Solly has given us a scientifically grounded compass. By shifting the ultimate criterion of the good from money value to life value, we systematically strip the ideological cover from extractive institutions. We recognize that human rights are only socially real when they are backed by the physical infrastructures of the civil commons.
Absolutely.
And by grounding all of this in the biology of love, the absolute requirement that the other arises as a legitimate other in coexistence, we finally have a metric for life-coherent stewardship. It shows us how to break the cycle of conserved civilizational drift, and it insists that we can do so without resorting to the very domination that made us sick in the first place.
I will readily agree that the white paper offers a flawless diagnostic grammar. Understanding how direct, structural, and cultural violence intertwine with our economic systems is an absolute revelation.
It really is.
But I stand by my critique. Its reliance on biological autonomy remains deeply paradoxical. The mechanisms proposed to cure this institutional pathology, you know, non-forcing governance, self-organization, and restraint, assume a level of fair play that predatory, money-sequenced institutions simply do not observe.
Fair enough.
It is a beautiful, profound vision of what a perfectly healthy society looks like once the disease is gone. But I remain skeptical that it provides the necessary friction to unseat the entrenched powers currently driving the illness.
We are clearly dealing with the immense complexity of translating biological imperatives into political realities. And, you know, perhaps that friction between the interventionist approach and the metabolic approach is something we will always have to navigate.
I think we will.
But evaluating our institutions by their ability to conserve and expand life capacity is an undeniably profound shift in perspective. It challenges us to look closely at our own communities.
Definitely.
If you're listening, I encourage you to explore the Life Coherent Governance Dashboard outlined in the paper and apply it to the institutions in your own life. Your local school board, your municipal water utility, the companies you work for.
Ask the mechanism question.
Yes, ask the mechanism question. Is this system enabling life, or is it disabling life simply to conserve itself? We finally have a rigorous diagnosis. The question now is whether we have the collective courage to fundamentally change the conditions of our social metabolism so that true healing can begin.
Well said.
Thanks for joining us on the debate.